The following Aloud podcast was recorded live in 2008 at the historic Central Library in the heart of downtown LA as part of the award-winning Aloud series presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Aloud podcasts are made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arent Fox and by individual contributions from listeners like you. For more information on Aloud, or to find out how you, too, can support the Los Angeles Public Library, please visit our website, www.aloudla.org. Jess Winfield was a founding member, as many of you here probably know, of the Reduced Shakespeare Company. I actually met him in 1987 when he was first pitching the idea over for the LA Fringe Festival. He performed at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival in 1987, and the Reduced Shakespeare Company went on to tour all over the world. Three men performing 37 plays in less than 2 hours. It included the shortest Hamlet ever performed, and then done backwards for an encore. In 1991, the show opened in the West End in London to rave reviews. Jess retired from the RSC in 1992, but the complete works continued with various casts, finally closing at Piccadilly's Criterion Theatre in 2005 as the longest-running comedy in the West End. Since then, Jess has had a successful second career as an Emmy Award-winning writer and producer for the Walt Disney Company. Now he's just published his first novel, My Name is Will, a novel of sex, drugs, and Shakespeare. It intertwines the lives of a struggling UC Santa Cruz grad student, Willie Shakespeare Greenberg, and that of the Bard. Publishers Weekly lauds Winfield for his deep understanding of Shakespeare's work, which is great, because in conversation with Jess tonight is a great scholar and teacher of the Bard, and some of you I know are here studying with Louis Fantasia, lucky you. Louis Fantasia is the director of Shakespeare at the Huntington, the Teacher Training Institute of the Huntington Library Art Collections and Botanical Gardens. He's been deeply involved with the rebuilding of the Shakespeare Globe in London for more than 20 years. Louis was the first American to direct on the reconstructed Globe stage and served on the Globe's U.S. Board of Directors. He is the author of The Instant Shakespeare and was heard for several years as the host of Theater Talk on KCRW. Louis knows his Shakespeare inside and out, and he's passionate about sharing his love for the Bard, so you all have a great treat in store for you tonight. Please welcome Jess Winfield and Louis Fantasia.
Nice turnout. Who are all you people?
Yeah, really? Oh, gosh. Before I stop my James Lipton imitation, I just wanted to say what a thrill it is for me to be back at the library. When we were doing all the Globe programs, we did several Shakespeare events here. And I just want to say this is, in my opinion, one of the great public spaces in America. So it's a real thrill for me to be back.
And I will also add to that, it's not only one of the great public spaces, but one of the truly great public libraries. It's very exciting for me to be back here, and I want to thank Louise and everybody for having me. I did so much of the research for the book right here and was just astounded at how many deep tomes of obscure Elizabethan and Shakespearean criticism they had here when I went to look for it. It's really an outstanding facility.
Okay, so we'll get started talking about Jess's book, which is a story of sex, drugs, and Shakespeare. And obviously, Louise asked me to help this evening because I was an expert in one of those fields. But I'll be damned if I'm saying which one. Okay, as Louise hinted at, it is really two stories. And what Jess has done, not only in the writing, but in the structure of the book, he's actually taking a page out of Shakespeare's structure. I don't know if he knows this or not. Shakespeare constructs his plays by what Francis Ferguson called analogy of action. You compare one thing against another, you know, Hamlet against Fortinbras, Macbeth's imaginary dagger against a real dagger, and so forth and so on. And he's got two stories of two wills who are involved on two journeys. They have to make deliveries, one of a box of Catholic relics, which we'll get to in a moment, and the other of a psychedelic mushroom. Suffice it to say, the psychedelic mushroom does not belong to the 1580 time period.
Although they were around then.
Were around. So what I want to do to start with is maybe just... No, I have to turn this way. Yeah. For you to tell us a little bit about the path from how you stumbled into Shakespeare as an undergraduate and how that got you to the reduced Shakespeare and then to the first novel, which isn't his first book, by the way, but first novel.
Sure. I stumbled into Shakespeare actually in high school. A two-man troupe from the Ashland Shakespeare Festival came around to our high school to perform, and they did a scene from Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead by Tom Stoppard, who has enlightened my career in more ways than one. And that, not surprisingly, got me to go and read Hamlet. I'd read Romeo and Juliet in seventh grade or something, but that really sort of turned me on to the possibility of Shakespeare, not only as an author himself, but also for adaptation of it. And in college, I had the great fortune to study with your friend Hugh Richmond, who taught at
UC Berkeley.
Yeah, at UC Berkeley, who teaches Shakespeare primarily through performance, and he's an expert in Shakespearean performance as it was presented in Elizabethan times. He actually worked on the Globe in London as well. And he was great about getting his students up on stage and performing. We actually did, I remember famously, at Sproul Plaza, or at Wheeler Hall, actually. They had four balconies overlooking Wheeler Hall, and we did for him a Romeo and Juliet 4x4, which had four Romeos, four Juliets in each of the balconies, each playing the scene simultaneously. And then I actually did Tom Stoppard's 15-minute Hamlet at Berkeley. And a few weeks later, I was at the Renaissance Fair in Northern California, and a friend of mine who I just saw, he's sitting right here somewhere, where's Daniel Singer, other founding member of the Reduced Shakespeare Company, got up on stage and said, "Hey, I'm having auditions for a half-hour version of Hamlet." And I didn't have a job at the time, and I went up to the auditions, and it turned out that he had taken Tom Stoppard's 15-minute Hamlet and added another 15 minutes to it, and so I knew half the lines already, so that got me cast in the Reduced Shakespeare Company. So I have Daniel Singer and, once again, Tom Stoppard to thank for getting that going.
And from there? Shakespeare,
from there,
Disney, books?
Yeah, Reduced Shakespeare Company. Louise said, we spent a good time on tour. Got to do the show in Japan, Australia, Canada, all over the British Isles, touring the show. And when I, as it says in my program nowadays, my program note, when I realized that I had performed the title role of Hamlet more times than John Gielgud and Laurence Olivier combined... I suddenly felt very old and retired in 92. I didn't know what I was going to do next, and a friend of mine was writing cartoons for Saturday morning shows, Walt Disney, and asked if I wanted to freelance a script, which I did, and that turned into another little 10-year career. By the end of that, I was writing and producing shows, perhaps the crowning glory of, once again, the shortening Shakespeare thing. I'm the go-to Shakespeare guy, in case you haven't noticed. We did a 7-minute version of Midsummer Night's Dream, starring Mickey Mouse, Minnie Mouse, Donald Duck, and Daisy Duck as the four lovers. And Goofy as Puck, which was...
Good casting.
Yeah.
Talk a little bit about the research you did here. Where did you look?
Well... I always wanted to write about this particular year in William Shakespeare's life, 1582, because it's, for me, he's 18 years old, he's presumably still stuck in Stratford, living with mom and dad, and he knocks up local farmer's daughter, Anne Hathaway. And how he got from that circumstance out of Stratford to London, made something of his life when it was liable that he was going to be tied to swaddling cloths and apron strings for the rest of his life. That, to me, was such a compelling human story that I really started from there. And it actually made it much easier to research the book because I only had to read the first three chapters of every Shakespeare biography. I didn't have to worry about what happened once he got to London.
That's called reduced research.
So I started with that, and then I didn't want to get pigeonholed as a writer of historical fiction, and I also wanted to do something that wasn't the Shakespeare guy. And I had the idea of doing a contemporary story because it actually paralleled my own growth. You know, it's a coming-of-age story for both Willie and William. And I sort of felt like when I quit Disney and decided I'm going to write this novel, that was also a, hey, I'm leaving Stratford and going off to London to try to make it in the theater moment. And that was a Willie, I have to get off my lazy ass and write this damn master's thesis. And what's going to happen to him in his life? You know, there's nothing that says that William Shakespeare, when he was 18, didn't know he was going to be William Shakespeare. Just as Willie, although you think he's a slacker and a stoner, by the end of the book, he's made some of the same strong choices that William Shakespeare has. And it started out from that love of that year in Shakespeare's life and sort of expanded to, well, how was I at that age? And then how am I now? And how am I still growing? So there are really three stories in the book, you know, Shakespeare's, Willie's, and then the narrator's, who is me.
So we have in the novel, you have these two parallel lines of 1582 and 1982, roughly?
1986,
right,
actually.
1986. Where you have in the Reagan years issues of drugs, sex, and just the beginnings of the AIDS crisis, and you go back and forth between these two time frames. Was there a time when working on the modern story you thought, oh my God, where's the parallel in the 1580s, or the other way around, you're working on the 1580s, and you think, oh my God, how did I get into this mess structurally? How do I write myself out of this corner?
Yeah, for a first novel, I knew going in that doing the dual timeline thing was going to be hell, and it was. Because if you're doing a dual timeline thing, you're going back and forth each time. If you change something in one chapter, you have to change it in the other chapter. God forbid you want to move part of a chapter, because then you have to move part of the other parallel chapter as well. But I found that the fun parallels were things that just sort of happened fortuitously more than anything. I had a scene where William Shakespeare is... gets paid sixpence by a friend of his to write a poem on the spot. And I had him pick up the sixpence and start flipping it. And while he's writing his first thing, and it sort of becomes a little lucky talisman for him. And then later on, when Willie Shakespeare Greenberg is at the Renaissance Fair, I have him running past booths trying to find his drug connection that he's supposed to make. And I was just thinking of the booths that were at the fair, and I remembered, oh, there's a numismatist booth, there's a coin booth, and they sell Elizabethan coinage. What if he stops and picks up, and on the spur of the moment, buys a coin, and that becomes his lucky talisman? Because he thinks, gosh, it's actually possible that William Shakespeare could have held this coin. And in fact, you know, the idea is it's the exact same coin, which is so cool.
I love authors who are happy, don't you?
But really, things like that, there's also a cod piece that appears in various scenes that's the same cod piece. And
everyone here know what that is?
But, you know, more than just little tricks like that, writing the chapters about William Shakespeare in 1582 were very difficult because every other word was research. William walks out into the street, and what is the street made of? Is it mud? Is it straw? Is it cobblestone? He walks down the street, and out of an open window... Oh, well, is the window, are they covered? Is there glass? Were they stretched with linen? Which, in fact, I found out they probably were. But literally, those chapters were just slogging through. Where I found, oh, writing about Willie Shakespeare Greenberg in Santa Cruz, that's going to be breezy. And, in fact, those were. I got through them very quickly. But then I got to the end, and I realized that the Shakespeare chapters, because I had struggled so hard with them, were much better and more compelling and richer. So I then really went back, and the last 6 months of the project were all sort of trying to bring up and elevate Willie Greenberg into a position where he could compete with this iconic historic figure of William Shakespeare. And that's where I started to really work on the parallelism.
One of the things you research is the issue of whether or not Shakespeare was a Catholic.
Yes.
You want to talk about that?
Well, in fact, I had read a book by Claire Asquith called Shadow Play, which suggested that Shakespeare was, in fact, a closet Catholic. This was at a time when Catholics are being hanged and drawn and quartered in the public squares for their religion. And I think it's probable that Shakespeare's family was, in fact, Catholic. And Claire Asquith's book was actually suggested that there are hidden coded messages in Shakespeare's work, very Da Vinci Code-esque stuff. And when I sat down to write the book, I was actually, that's what it was going to be about. It was going to be Da Vinci Code for Shakespeare, and it's all Catholic intrigue and so forth. And in fact, that's what Willie's thesis is going to be about when he sets out at the beginning. It's going to be about how William Shakespeare was a Catholic. But then, and this is part of the journey of writing the book as well as researching it, as the book went along, I came to the conclusion that I don't think at the end of the day Shakespeare was Catholic. I think he was, in fact, the first humanist in literature, and his plays are not infused with religious dogma. That's why they're so good. There is so little political commentary and so much just drawing out of the human condition to such an extent that it's almost impossible to tell what Shakespeare's personal or political or religious beliefs are. And that's sort of the conclusion that both I and Willie come to, is that he's not promoting an agenda. He's just promoting the spirit of man.
Shall we read a bit?
Sure.
Want to set this up?
Yeah, actually, that's a good, nice segue.
Thank you. Thank you.
I'll read one of the Willie Greenberg selections. This is a couple of chapters in, so just to catch you up, Willie has spent 3 years trying to write his master's thesis, and he hasn't really begun yet. He's sort of...
It is UC Santa Cruz, after all.
He's a little bit caught up, first of all, because he feels the pressure of his name, William Shakespeare Greenberg. And he hasn't really been able to write anything about the Bard because the pressure is just too great. And he also has some personal family issues, which we might get into later. But he finally, it's down to the wire, he goes in to pitch his master's thesis proposal to his professor, Clarence Welsh, but he finds that Clarence Welsh is actually on holidays on his book tour, so he's asked instead to pitch it to Clarence Welsh's Top Gun doctoral candidate, who is the impossibly beautiful and smart and sexy Dashka Dimitra. And he pitches his thesis that Shakespeare was a closet Catholic, and she doesn't really believe it. She doesn't think it's a very good idea for a thesis, but... she is also kind of attracted to Willie, and so she lets him get by with it. Willie's about to get up and go out the door, and his backpack flops open, and a porn magazine falls out open onto the floor in front of Dashka. And as he's trying to gather that up, the front pouch of his backpack opens, and his hash pipe clatters out in front of her. In front of Dashka, and she sort of looks at it, and he is stuck between a rock and a hard place and says, want some? So the next scene with them takes place out in, I don't know if anybody here is familiar with UC Santa Cruz, but it's set up on the hillside above Monterey Bay, just at the tree line, and going down from the campus, there are these cow fields, these cattle fields. And one of the more popular pastimes among UC Santa Cruz students who are so inclined is to go not cow tipping as they do in some campuses, but what we would call cow tripping, which is you go out into the fields, you look for magic mushrooms in the cow patties, and if you find them, you take them. So Willie is out with Dashka in the cow fields of UC Santa Cruz, and they find a couple of very small mushrooms in a cow patty, and they eat them. Oh, I can stand up and do this.
Because I have a magic microphone. Thanks, Bob. So, an hour later, Willie still had the taste of the mushroom on his tongue, but he was beginning not to care. The high had started in his stomach, some rumbling and bloating, a mild reaction to the fungus. He briefly had the thought, heightened by pot paranoia, that he could have been wrong with his mushroom identification. Maybe I'm dying. But then he and Dashka took another toke of the mellow Lebanese hash. Almost immediately, his stomach relaxed, one of the well-known medical effects of tetrahydrocannabinol, the active ingredient in both marijuana and hashish. Dashka shivered and snuggled up next to him, sheltering from the chilly bay breeze now blowing up over the pastures. "The sky is fucking amazing," she said, looking up. "You can see the nebula in Orion's sword," said Willie. Funny, Willie thought. Why did the Greeks, who were into anything priapic, call it Orion's sword rather than Orion's wang? It's so there. No sword ever hung so directly between the legs. Well, true, the girth would, if it were a phallus, make Orion exceedingly well hung. But what the hell? He was a giant, right? You'd expect him to have a giant cock, too, maybe even well out of proportion, the better for terrifying the local maidenry. Maybe the ancients were thinking that Orion must be wearing a tunic since he's wearing a belt. But why did it have to be a belt? Why not just his waist? The Greeks were mostly naked anyway, especially their heroes. No, the banana-shaped object must surely, to the ancient Greeks, have been Orion's tool. There must have been some intervening repressive regime, no doubt Northern European, who decided that the constellation of Orion's Johnson would somehow offend Jesus. And so, for the sake of public morality and entrance to the kingdom of heaven, covered up his great hunter's loins with a tunic and turned his wiener into a sword. Or worse, a hunting knife. His naked blade, more like. Beaver hunting knife. Ha! First thing tomorrow, I'm going to start a public campaign to have the constellation referred to by its full and proper name, Orion the Hunter, he of the shining waist and massive schlong. Willie was stoned. He was just embarking on a tributary stream of consciousness about whether any planets in the constellation of Orion's schlong might be inhabited, and what they would think if they knew that they lived on a big interstellar dick. When his reverie was interrupted. "What's that?" Dashka asked. "What? That galaxy or supernova? That?" Willie was always amazed when otherwise intelligent people didn't know the difference between a galaxy, a supernova, and the Pleiades, which, he informed Dashka, was the cluster of newborn stars she was pointing at. "It looks like it's waving, shimmering. It's like fairy cobweb." They sat for a while, just looking at the stars. "So why Catholicism?" Dashka asked suddenly. "Why is Shakespeare's religion important? Why should we care? Why do you care?" Willie couldn't tell her the truth, that he didn't really care, at least not about Catholicism. He couldn't tell her that the research for his thesis consisted of the last hour of a movie about Sir Thomas More and one line from a sonnet that he'd stumbled across while frantically trying to pull together a thesis, any thesis, for his already scheduled approval meeting. Willie smoked a little more to cover the fact that he didn't have an answer and found himself asking why, aside from the compelling oddity of his own name, he cared about a dead playwright. "Why do I care? What's the bard to me, or me to the bard, to paraphrase Hamlet, Act 2, Scene 2, yet here I am quoting Shakespeare, even to myself, like verses from the Bible or something. Why?" Finally, he said, grasping to tie it all together, "I guess Shakespeare's the closest thing I have to a religion. Maybe if I figure out his faith, his God, his passion, whatever it was that moved him..." "Then you figure it out yourself?" Dashka interrupted. "Heavy, man. Self-realization via Shakespeare. Well, Catholicism isn't an option for me, so maybe I'll find the meaning of life in a sonnet." He crumbled a little more Lebanese into the bowl. "Or maybe in a cow patty. Or a hash pipe," he said, reaching for the lighter next to Dashka. She snatched it up and held it away from him teasingly. "Or maybe you'll find it somewhere else." She took his right hand, put the tips of his fore and middle finger in her mouth, and sucked them where they were dusted with the sticky residue of the hash. Sweet. Sex, drugs, and Shakespeare, Willie said. A sure path to nirvana. Who said anything about sex? Dashka said and began giggling, and soon they were both laughing. Willie was grinding his teeth together as the endorphins released by laughter and arousal raised his heart rate, and the blood pumped psilocybin faster and faster into his brain, and suddenly he was peaking, his face feeling like chilled alabaster, his breathing like silk, his torso. Where was his torso, anyway? He suddenly felt impossibly skinny, as if he could put his hands on either side of his waist and pinch them together. He was giggling uncontrollably, his nose running, his eyes streaming with tears of laughter, his tear ducts feeling raw and swollen to the size of chestnuts. The next thing he knew, he and Dashka were kissing and dry humping, the short, dry cattle-mown grass from the summer crunching beneath them, a few green blades born of an early fall rain, releasing a freshly scented hint of spring yet to come. Dashka had her knee between Willie's legs, rubbing his hard on with her thigh, and he could feel a sticky stain developing on his boxers. He wedged a hand in between his own leg and her crotch and rubbed, getting a suggestion of labia, but mostly just hard blue jean seam. He was wondering if he should try to unbutton her jeans or maybe get to her bra when she rolled him over twice, laughing, ending up with her on top and Willie with his temple 1 inch away from a huge cow patty. He did a take and then a double take. Crowning the patty was the largest mushroom he'd ever seen. Psychedelic mushrooms, when one is tripping on mushrooms, have an eerie blue glow about them, like Frodo's sword when orcs are near. This one was haloed like the aurora borealis, shimmering blue with a secondary corona of shifting green and white. Holy fucking shit. Willie said, and he meant every word.
So, a novel of sex, drugs, and Shakespeare. Jess, how autobiographical is it?
Well, you know, I lived every single moment of William Shakespeare's life in 1582. there are obviously certain scenes and places and people that that I wrote about, but I went to Santa Cruz for a year. I was never a graduate student there. I don't have a graduate degree. Willie is raised by his father and his teenage stepmom in Berkeley.
Teenage nymphomaniacs.
In fact, that couple was actually more inspired by Bill S. Preston's dad and stepdad in Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure than my own life. So some of the scenes and places, but as far as the sex scenes go, I'm sad to say they're almost entirely fictional. Like I say, they're really the three stories in this, and a lot of the sights, sounds, and smells are the same, but more importantly, Willie's character sort of captures some of the ennui that I felt at actually a slightly younger age than he is. I didn't take 3 years to write a master's thesis, mostly because I never wrote a master's thesis. Oh my God, it's taken me 30 years
to do the first novel. Let's talk about that. What's your writing process? How do you, when you're working as a writer, what do you like to do?
I like to write. I like the story to carry me a little bit. I'm an outliner, but only in rough form. When I was writing this, I really didn't know how it was going to end, and that was very exciting to me because I wanted to find out how it was going to end. I wanted to find out which girl, if any, my two characters were going to end up with, and I really truly didn't know. When I first sat down to write it, I had the idea for this dual parallel structure. So I sat down and wrote the first two chapters just to see if they would be fun at all and whether I could do it. And that went okay. I showed them to a few people. They were like, yes, you should write this book. My wife, mainly. Saw, who's sitting there, who is not a huge reader. She was going to wear a T-shirt tonight that said, "I don't read, I watch television." So I was pretty confident that if she was excited about a couple of chapters, it was good. So I sat down and wrote the first two chapters, and then decided, yeah, I need to figure out where the story's going and outline the whole damn thing, and researched it and spent some time on the story, and then went back and wrote it. But partly from my time at Disney, where nothing is ever done and you get notes from everyone, I showed the book to a lot of people and got very good notes from them. I also worked very closely with a couple of writer friends. Franz is here. We had a very small writers group that we did close reads of each other's work in, and that was very helpful. So I think partly my collaborative theater and television experience really forced me to have to workshop and focus group test it and all that during the process of writing it.
Do you want to talk about the other two books?
Sure. No, but sure.
They're not for sale in the lobby.
The first one was actually the book of the play, The Reduced Shakespeare Company's Complete Works of William Shakespeare, Abridged, which was really fun for me because it was just the text of the play, but then my publisher had the idea to do a bunch of ridiculous footnotes, so I put myself in the character of Professor J.M. Winfield, who wrote all these absurd footnotes with various scholarly pissing contests back and forth over the decades. I'm very proud of that. And it was sort of my swan song to the Reduced Shakespeare Company. And then the next one was oddly enough, a self-help book entitled What Would Shakespeare Do?, which was meant to be the literary secular answer to the What Would Jesus Do? Phenomenon, and the follow-up to Franz's book, What Would Buddha Do? From the same publisher. And that one, it has some good bits in it, but there was a little bit of a tug of war with the publisher because I thought it should be more a parody of self-help books, and he wanted it to actually be a self-help book. And I think it...
Oh, those publishers.
And I'm not sure that I'm qualified at all to be a self-help writer. But so I think it ended up being a little neither here nor there.
What do you like to read?
I like to read... I like reading that's both funny and deep. I'm on a Hunter S. Thompson jag at the moment. I'm a big Tom Robbins fan. I like anybody who can string a beautiful sentence together. I'm actually a very slow reader. I get very caught up in sentence structure and alliteration and sonorousness and the poetry of a line. So it actually takes me a good long time to work through a book that I really love. And I read a lot of classic fiction. I'm more likely to be reading Jane Austen or Don Quixote than Don DeLillo, say. Not that Don DeLillo's not a great writer. He is.
I want you to take out Don DeLillo today on your way home.
Yeah. I'm a big T.C. Boyle fan of contemporary writers.
What's your favorite Shakespeare play?
Ah. Well, I would have to say Hamlet, just because... he's so closely associated with my history in so many ways. But for an outside dark horse play, I'm a big Cymbeline fan.
Good.
Because it's got a little bit of everything. It's got the shipwrecks. It's got the identical twins. It's got... What more do you need than a scene of mistaken identity where a woman is holding a body that she thinks is her lover but doesn't know it isn't because his head is cut off? That is just, doesn't get any better than that.
What's your least favorite Shakespeare play?
My least favorite Shakespeare play? Probably Pericles, Prince of Tyre. I acted in it for Hugh Richmond, in fact, at the Greek Theater in UC Berkeley. And it's just... of course, it's sort of apocryphal, and people will argue about whether or not he wrote this bit or that bit.
Right.
But it feels very, very strung together, like it was written by committee, and the scenes that are bad are terrifically bad. Mm-hmm. Come on! Shakespeare wrote some bad stuff, too. Not everything that flowed forth from the man
is
pen
golden.
Was genius.
Absolutely, absolutely. We've got about 10 minutes before we go to questions. Is that right, Louise? So, well, no, but I think what I want to do is have Jess read from his second excerpt.
Should I? I felt like the first one went a little long. I want to have time to add. Yeah?
Okay.
Maestro, thank you. So this is, and I'll try to be briefer in the setup for it, this is essentially the scene where William Shakespeare jumps on a stage for the first time. Again, he's 18 years old. He's out in the forest with some friends of his. They're going to put on a play. There's actually a bit in the historical record about a performance that was done in Stratford-upon-Avon by a local director named Davy Jones in the spring of the year following the time that I'm writing about. And I thought, oh, well, Shakespeare, the young would-be theatrical rake, probably was involved with that somehow. So this is him and his own sort of group of mechanicals from Midsummer Night's Dream out in the forest. And the director, Davy Jones, wants to put on a pageant of Robin Hood. And William thinks that this is too fraught with political commentary. Too difficult to explain why, but he does. And he suggests that they do a bit of Ovid instead. And everybody says, Ovid, who's that? And someone suggests, well, why don't you tell us how the story goes? So he jumps up on the stage, and he catches the eye of a pretty young girl in the audience. And he says he's going to do the story of Salmasis and Hermaphroditus. And he needs a woman. And the young guy who's supposed to play all the women's roles says, ah, here I go. And he says, no, let's have an actual woman do it. As it says, no man present knew quite how to respond to William Shakespeare, as no man in England had ever said anything quite like this before, having a woman on the stage. So she comes up, and William begins to extemporize his story. William took a breath, strode forward one step, and began. Behold, good gentles all, the Grecian scene, wherein beneath the creeping shade Olympus casts, fauns, satyrs, and centaurs roam, and where the crocus blooms at Whitsuntide. William gestured toward Rosalind. There, a nymph divine, which yon bonny English maid presents. Oh, this is going to be good.
You're on your own.
Which yon bonny maid presents, was wont to bathe at leisure in her pool. Now follows, if you will, the tale of Hermaphroditus, from blood immortal born, who stumbled upon Salmasis' grotto fair, and sealed thus his doom, and mayhap yours and mine. He bowed with a flourish, and everyone applauded and hooted. William smiled. He felt like a god. See the nymph, said William, bathing naked in her pool. He gestured to Rosalind and kicked toward her the one small stool that stood upon the stage. It slid neatly across and stopped inches from her shapely derriere. She sat. Bathing naked, he said, heckled Arthur Codrey, and all the other men laughed. Rosalind replied with mock offense. Let thy imagination reveal what my modesty may hide, she said. The merry band of brothers laughed. She turned upstage and cast a longing glance into the distance. William continued. Salmasis hunts not, nor toils at loom nor well, but all day combs her hair, bathing lissome limbs in waters clear and fine. Rosalind took a comb from her hair, letting it cascade around her shoulders. Languidly, she began. Languidly, she began to pull the comb through long tresses. William stepped back to the rear of the stage. Comes a youth of features fair, in which his father and mother might both be seen, of whom he also took his name. William, enacting the weary traveler, strode forward.
Hermaphroditus is he, of Mercury and Venus born, and 15 be his age. Adventuring from his country far to see the world, into fair Kyria he roams. By chance, the nymph divine has left the pool to gather flowers for her hair, and strayed amongst the woods nearby. Rosalind, taking William's cue, danced lightly to the edge of the stage and mimed, plucking flowers. When from behind a tree, William continued, the beauteous youth does she espy. Rosalind ducked behind the branch of the tree that o'erhung the back of the stage and gazed at William as he enacted the youth. Rosalind swooned with instant love. What god is this? She aside to the audience, which was by now rapt. Even Davy Jones held his half-full cup dangling unattended between his legs. Fair is he beyond any mortal I e'er have seen, Rosalind continued with rising passion. His face, his hair, his chest, his limbs bespeak of blood divine. Have him I must, have him I will. Will I not? Say aye. The audience answered heartily,
aye.
Rosalind, as though looking in a mirror, took a minute to scrunch her hair. She curled a curl. She took a little finger to each corner of her lips. She hoisted her breasts up in her bodice, showing them to their best advantage. Young Richard Tyler leaned over to Philip Rogers in the audience. Is a maid so cunning when she woos, so forward? The stage is but a shadow of nature, my boy, Rogers replied. You have no idea. Rosalind turned to William. Oh, most stately boy, or are you a god? If a god, then surely the god of love. If mortal, how blessed are your father and mother. How happy your brother. But, and now she stalked toward William, predatory like a fox toward the hare, so much more blessed and happy was whoever had the good fortune to be your sister. Here the audience exchanged uncomfortable glances. Davy Jones bristled and drained his cup with eyes still fixed on the stage. And even more, teased Rosalind. And she reached out and slowly circled a fingertip lightly around William's left nipple. Even more blessed, she who nursed you. She let her finger trail down William's trunk toward his belt. She who gave you suck. But how much more blessed she who becomes thy wife, thy bedfellow. The last word hung in the air for a perfect moment before William turned to the audience. She knows her Ovid well. Sensing a climax, William took a step toward the edge of the stage. We may gallop apace through the rest, as I think you apprehend the particular tone. She woos the youth, but he, knowing aught of love and much afeard, the nymph denies. About the wood he roams, as she, behind a bush, hides as only nymphs can hide. The youth, unknowing, espies her pool. Clear as crystal, no sign of weed or reed, of fen or bog. Aye, the very pebbles of the pool, a fathom deep, glitter through the shimmering waves and beckon him to dive. At first he dips a toe, and then a foot into the lapping water. At last, thinking himself alone, and here William paused a moment for effect. The fair youth puts off his robes, and naked doth his body shine. His beauty strikes Salmasis in her ardent eye, inflaming her with sudden passion. Barely can she restrain her desire to run and take him there, ere he claps his hollow hands against his naked flesh, raises arms, and into the water glides. And with that he mimed Hermaphroditus' fateful dive into the pool of Salmasis. Imagine, if you will, our stagecraft here, a simple trick of azure water made of fabric flowing by. Hermaphroditus swims before it, his arms flashing white. Salmasis cries aloud, oh! And spraying clothes aside, she, naked, casts herself into the pool. As Rosalind mimed diving into the pool, Arthur Codrey heckled again, naked, he said. She envelops him, holds him, and struggle though he might, escape he is denied. Beneath the waves, their bodies entwine, flesh pressing into flesh, and Salmasis cries unto the gods. Rosalind, now wrapped around William, standing on one toe, one leg about his waist, cried to the heavens, "Gods, hear me! Grant my prayer that this unholy, willful boy shall never from me sundered be." William, still in Rosalind's arms, turned his face out to the audience. And the gods, good gentles, did grant indeed her prayer, joining their bodies in one, yet leaving privy members twain. And Hermaphroditus, once a manly youth, beholding what he had become, soft and yielding, cursed all else who bathed in those waters clear to share his fate. And so it is, my friends, that if you bathe, beware towards what ends. And with that, still entwined, William and Rosalind kissed. Their audience stood, cheered, lifted their cups, clanked them together, and drained them. On the stage, Rosalind leaned close into William's ear. "You, William Shakespeare," she whispered under the applause, "ought not enact the minor role of country schoolmaster, but rather a player, poet, and by God's very prick, I prithee, a lover be."
Shall we take some questions from the audience? Raise your hand and I'll send Libby with the microphone to you. This lady here.
Libby with the microphone.
This one, right in the white.
Actually, it's two quick questions. The first is, who do you want to write the screenplay, you or Tom Stoppard?
I think a collaboration would be in order.
Excellent. And the other thing is, if you were to recommend one single Shakespeare biography, which one would it be?
Oh, that's a very good question. The recent Will in the World by Stephen Greenblatt is terrific. There's a newer one, which...
Michael Ackroyd?
Yeah, Michael Ackroyd's, which I have honestly...
Which actually argues that Shakespeare was a Catholic. Michael Ackroyd's new book, yeah.
They're both excellent. I also very much liked a book called Shakespeare, the Evidence, by an author whose name eludes me, which was very much sort of just presenting historical evidence without commentary on the... I can't even believe I'm mentioning the words authorship question.
Don't ask. Leave now. this lady in the blue had a question. Wait for the microphone.
Actually,
it's your big moment.
Been partially answered because I was going to ask if you had used Will in the World for some of the knowledge of who William was and how he came to be so educated and so knowledgeable.
Well, the answer is I actually did not read Will in the World until I was nearly done with the book. So it confirmed a lot of stuff, and I found it to be a very interesting read, but it was not part of my primary source material for this. Although, really quick, funny story, though. Someone told me that my Willie Shakespeare Greenberg character was clearly a parody of Stephen Greenblatt. Because, in fact, Willie, sort of, in writing his thesis, comes up with what he calls new historicalism, which is the school of thought that Greenblatt sort of pioneered. And it also turned out that Greenblatt was teaching at Berkeley and surfing in Santa Cruz during the same time period that I was writing about. So I actually wrote him a letter saying, "Hey, apparently I have a book out that's all about you."
And he would say, "Yes, you do." Next question.
Got one
where?
Up there in the back.
Oh, in the back, okay.
In your Shakespeare portion of the novel, did you find that you had to avoid what was done in Shakespeare in Love?
You know, I almost didn't read that section today because it's that, oh, yeah, it's a woman on stage. How clever is that? And I did try to avoid Shakespeare in Love. I knew I wasn't really going to get very close to it because it all takes place before Shakespeare goes to London. So it's really not any of the same milieu. So I really wasn't too worried about that. Although I had actually already written... I wrote a treatment for Walt Disney Feature Animation called "The Story of Young Will, the Almost, the Incredible Almost True Life Story of Young William Shakespeare and a Muse Named Bob," which was a story about William Shakespeare arriving in London with two spec scripts in his bag and trying to break into the theater business. And it had all sorts of Hollywood jokes in it, and Disney was all over it. They were going to make it, and then all of a sudden, the development on the project stopped. And I found out later that it was because Miramax had a little film called Shakespeare in Love already in production, and with Tom Stoppard attached. So I've always called that Tom Stoppard's revenge for our stealing his 15-minute Hamlet. Was he killed my Disney movie.
The lady there in the front row. Yes.
Do any Pope holes feature in the book?
Do any what?
Pope holes.
Oh, I think you're referring to what I know as priest hides. Yeah. There is a priest hide scene in the book. In fact, this is Catholic priests were in such danger at this time that Catholic noble families would essentially keep priests on retainer to say mass in secret on their grounds, and they had to have some place for them to hide when the priest hunters came looking for them. And yes, as a matter of fact, there is a scene where Sir Thomas Lucy's men show up at William Shakespeare's uncle Edward Arden's house, and they quickly break up a mass, and William ends up hiding with the priest hide in him for a couple of hours. They'd be hidden, you know, behind chimneys and under staircases, and there was a very famous priest hide builder who was famous for building these contraptions, and no two alike anywhere, and they're actually quite ingenious when you get into reading about them.
One and two. Wait for the mic.
How do you do a movie of two different stories in two different eras? What's the structure of the movie?
That's for Tom Stoppard to figure out.
Well, it's not a movie.
Well, you know, it is. This is not a movie yet, although I very much look forward to that. You know, my favorite dual timeline movie, which actually was inspiring in writing this, was Harold Pinter's adaptation of John Fowle's French Lieutenant's Woman, which weaves the two stories together seamlessly about the actors, the two actors, Jeremy Irons and Meryl Streep, playing the roles of these Victorian characters in a novel. Which is a brilliant adaptation of Fowle's book, which wherein the narrator is commenting about Victorian fiction extensively, and you know, I figure if that story could be done, mine could somehow.
Possibly.
Yes.
Down there.
When Shakespeare's 18, his father had gone into sort of a public decline, going from, in effect, being the mayor of Stratford and one of the leading citizens, and then something happened. And how do you deal with this, or do you at all in the book?
In fact, that's central to the book. This is the main thing that William has to overcome, is that his family has gone into very dire circumstances. And in my book, it's because they are, in fact, Catholic. It's very difficult at those times for people in public positions to walk the line between their faith and their public service. About 10 years before the time of this book, all public officials were forced to sign a statement acknowledging Queen Elizabeth as the head of the church. And if they didn't sign that and they didn't show up in church on Sundays, they were harassed by the local authorities. So in my book, John Shakespeare has essentially been taxed and fined and harassed pretty much out of his business, out of his public standing as mayor, and is literally hiding out in his own backyard because he's not willing to give up his faith and sign that oath. I actually did have him sign the oath, but he claims to not be appearing in church for fear of process of debt, which is something that people actually did. They said they weren't going to church because they were afraid their creditors would come get them, but in fact they weren't going to church because they were being forced to Protestant worship when they were Catholic.
Next question, in back. as we all watch Libby walk up the stairs.
Nothing wrong with that.
Thank you. So very briefly, do you think Shakespeare wrote the plays, or was it De Vere?
You want to go first?
Why don't you go first?
Oh, you go first.
Yes, I believe Shakespeare wrote the plays. There's my simple answer to that is that there is all manner of evidence that Shakespeare wrote the plays. The testaments of his own contemporaries, the fact that his name appears on every book of the plays that were published in his lifetime. And there is absolutely no evidence whatsoever that Edward de Vere did. Period. You can make stuff up. There are claims that, oh, he knew people who were just like the characters in this play or that play. But he never claimed to have written them. Nobody he ever knew claimed to have written them. And there's no reason to go there. I could just as well say that that anybody in Elizabethan times wrote those plays. And in fact,
it was Elizabeth, it was Francis Bacon, it was De Vere, it was Marlowe. Because Marlowe would have had to have faked his own death in a barroom brawl and then gone to Italy and hidden for 25 years to pretend to be Shakespeare.
And that's the case with any of them. They all require vast conspiracy theories on the part of the printers, the press, Shakespeare's friends, heirs, assigns, artists who drew him, friends who wrote about him. And it's
too much work.
Too much work.
Well, one more question, I think. Yes, sir. Wait for the mic.
But I'm having so much fun. I could talk about my book for hours.
Well, I was about how the theme of love... that question because it's... you guys warned us not to ask it. But in the academia, why was it such a controversy? I mean, I went to Berkeley myself in the 70s.
Go Bears.
And this, you almost like, let's not go there, but academics were really taking this thing so seriously that it was in all
schools. You mean the authorship question?
Exactly. So where did this argument derive from?
Because they have to write about something to keep their jobs.
But that's such a huge conspiracy, let's say. I mean, this was just across the whole planet, this debate. And
well,
do you know where it came from or where it
started
the origin?
It started out, and this is no joke, with a man named Looney, who first started, actually it started earlier than that, with a woman named Delia Bacon, who was no relationship to Sir Francis Bacon, but by the time she went mad in a nut house in upstate New York, was convinced she was. So the first two, to be generous, eccentrics had sort of agendas, and then slowly and gradually, I think, really, mid-60s, late-60s, it started to be this idea that, you know, this stuff couldn't have come from somebody out of nowhere, no background, no research, no connections, blah, blah, blah. It had to be X, Y, and Z, and therefore people found all kinds of research opportunities and grants. But as I put it, for those of you who remember a TV program called Star Trek, right? You don't need to be a Klingon to write for Star Trek. Understand?
Yeah, I mean the simple answer to the question, and if we're, I hate that we're ending on this, but. It comes from class hatred is where it comes from. It comes from the premise that it begins with is that a commoner like William Shakespeare could not possibly have written these exalted plays. That is the premise that set people out looking for nobles and politicians and queens and earls who could have done it instead. And to me, as a writer, and I think all of you know that the greatest art tends not to come from nobles and queens and kings, but from people who live and grow and learn and take risks and experiment and sow wild oats and do drugs and have love affairs and knock up local farmers' daughters. Then they have something to write about.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arendt Fox. Additional support is provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, City National Bank, KPMG, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. Aloud theme composed by David Ornette Cherry.